Hi, everyone. Judge Andrew Napolitano here for Judging Freedom. Professor Jeffrey Sachs joins us now. Professor Sachs, a pleasure, my dear friend.
Thank you.
I want to talk to you at some length about the collaboration, you can call it a plot if you want, between Israel and the United States against Iran. But before we do, can we lay to rest what the president has been saying as recently as yesterday, Sunday, on Fox Business, where he boasted once again that his bombs, and he used that phrase, totally obliterated the nuclear capabilities of Iran. Is this true or isn't it true?
It's plainly false. It is absolutely false. Iran did not sit around with its enriched uranium waiting for this to happen. It almost surely secreted it out to other sites. There is simply no way that a firm conclusion can be reached that this ended Iran's nuclear capacities. It did not. Now, I think it's also important to say that Iran has made perfectly clear for 20 years, and I had discussions today with a senior Iranian diplomat. They don't want atomic bombs. They don't want the burdens of them. They do not want to make themselves a target of nuclear war in that way. They do not want them, but they do not want to be overthrown by Israel's murderous government. And that is a problem. And last week was an attempt by the Israeli government, which is a rogue state, the most dangerous on the entire planet, to kill the Iranian leadership. Not only the supreme leader, but government officials as well. They succeeded in many murders, but they did not succeed in the regime change operation. Then came this U.S. bombing of these sites. It did not change anything, in my view, in the nuclear calculation, but it made everything far worse in terms of the potential. When I say didn't change anything, it didn't change anything in terms of Iran's capacity to produce atomic bombs, or, by the way, to obtain them from others. All it did was make the situation far more dangerous, because now there is no inspection taking place. The Iranians know without question that they were targeted in a very deadly regime change operation. They know that the United States was party to it. They know that European countries are basically vassal states of the United States, so won't say one word on their own. So they know that they were targeted for assassinations and regime change. That does not make the situation safer today than last week. It makes everything far more reckless and dangerous.
So I guess the answer is also no. When President Trump boasts, as he did as recently as last night, that Iran was, quote, weeks away, close quote. Secretary Hegseth has said the same thing, from developing a bomb. There is no basis for that. It's just political claptrap.
If Iran wanted to make a mad dash for a bomb, it could have done so in the past. There is, as I think everybody now understands, a religious ruling many years ago that Iran does not want a bomb. There were negotiations for years where Iran said, we give over our nuclear materials, we open ourselves up to inspection, we do not want a bomb. We do not want unilateral disarmament because Israelis will murder us, period. So they don't want to be murdered by Netanyahu and his gangsters. But on the other hand, they don't want a bomb, even though Israel, of course, has many nuclear weapons. If there's a rogue state in terms of atomic weapons, it's, of course, Israel. Why is there no
conversation about that? Why is there no national in the U.S. or international conversation about how Israel, without signing the non-proliferation treaty, without permitting any inspections, and on the basis of stolen information, has a nuclear weapon, but Iran's not permitted to have one? What kind of justice is that?
Not only does Israel have nuclear weapons, it's not only and also not part of the non-proliferation treaty, but of course there's no international verification or inspection of anything that Israel does. There is discussion all over the world, just not in the United States and its vassal states in Europe and in Israel. So this is a game. It's the ultimate double standard, but that's part of the point of empire, by the way. The American policy is not to pretend that there is a consistent line. The Americans and the Israelis in their way want to say, there are rules. The rules apply to you. We do anything we want and don't forget it. And that's not hidden. That's part of the whole idea. That is, we will kill you if you don't follow our rules. And we mean it. We don't have to follow them. We don't have to have international standards, but we have the rules. That's the so-called rules-based order. It means America sets the rules for others, not for itself. So there is discussion all over the world, but in the United States, there is not. And that comes back to our domestic politics. It comes back to the Zionist hold on American politics, which, remember, is as much or more a Christian evangelical movement as it is a Jewish movement. The Jewish community is more divided on this point than the Christian evangelicals, who vastly outnumber the Jews in terms of voting power and in terms of Trump's base. But there's a lot of money that is invested in making sure that the Congress of the United States is 100% subservient, and that whoever occupies the White House understands that their job is to do what Israel says.
Which country had the better outcome from the 12-day war, Iran or Israel?
Israel suffered massive losses, many direct hits in Haifa, in Beersheba, in Tel Aviv, the Iron Dome, and the other parts of the system, because that's just one component of Israel's air defense system, failed on multiple occasions. Iran has missiles that can penetrate Israel's air defenses, and Israel got hit hard, but it could have and could be in the future hit far harder. So Israel suffered a lot. Israel has no impunity in this and will get hit harder and harder each time this is done. Israel may have told, according to some stories, I have no idea whether it's true, may have assured Trump, don't worry, it's a 24-hour operation. We murder the whole top of the government. We have a new government in place shortly. All will go well. That obviously did not happen at all, nor did the defenses work the way that the Israeli censors want us to believe. There was direct military censorship from Israel after the second or third day. We did not see all of the damage, but people posted a lot of the damage, and we know that it was extensive, and very, very real, and very dangerous for Israel. But this is also just to say that Israel's been making wars for 30 years and drawing the United States into wars for 30 years that has not improved Israel's security. This is the irony. Same with the United States. We could be the most secure country in the history of the world, and yet we're closer to nuclear Armageddon than ever because of our flagrant, blatant irresponsibility of pushing us closer to the brink because we do not play fairly at all. We cheat on everything, every day. Every day is a lie, and every day threatens to push us to the nuclear brink, whether it's with Russia or with the many other countries that have nuclear weapons right now. It's the only risk we face, but we're not behaving the president and the deep state in a way which actually protects us, though we should be the safest people in the whole world. But we're absolutely, as the atomic scientists tell us in their doomsday clock, we're the closest to nuclear war and the closest to self-destruction since the start of the nuclear age. We're just blowing it because we cannot seem to understand basic facts of how to have stable, honest, truthful, peaceful relations with other countries.
What did the United States gain by Trump's dropping of these bunker busters?
I think they wanted to try out these bombs. They want to look tough. Trump said it was the greatest bombing in the history of the world, or he compared it to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which itself is an amazing thing for any president to say, especially if one happens to know the history of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because the history is not as every school child has been told for the last 80 years, that it saved American lives from invading Japan at the end of World War II. That's the bunkum story. The true story is that Japan was begging to surrender. It wanted to keep the emperor. The United States said, we're going to drop the bombs first, because Truman wanted to make a big show to Stalin, mostly. It did not save any American lives, because in the end, the United States said, yes, the emperor stays anyway. Neither of those bombs needed to be dropped. But I make the point that Trump just, he said, no, I shouldn't make that comparison. But then he made the comparison. That's not an accident. He's bloviating. He wants to say, look at how powerful the United States is. We can do what we want. We can blow you up. So that's what he thinks he gained. But in fact, it doesn't work this way in actuality. The United States can't do what it wants. A lot of the world understands that very, very well. The more we have this bloviating, the less the United States is able to enter into any kind of serious agreement with any other country on any substantive issue. This is extremely hazardous for the American people to have a political system that is completely untrusted and untrustworthy by others.
I'm going to ask you in a minute about the nature and extent of American and Israeli collaboration against Iran. But before I do, I want you to watch a rather extraordinary video of David Barnea, you know who he is, the head of Mossad, thanking the CIA and the CIA director for all of its help. I don't know why this fellow allowed himself to be videoed doing this, unless he plans on running against Netanyahu for prime minister, but that's another topic for another time. Chris, cut number 6.
I also want to express appreciation and gratitude to our main partner, the CIA, for the joint operations and the missions that were carried out, and also to the head of the CIA, who supported the Mossad in making the right decisions, which ultimately made this operation possible. We will continue to keep a very close watch on all the projects in Iran, which we know in the most thorough way, and we will be there just as we have been until now. But we must not forget that there are still 50 hostages in the Gaza Strip, 30 deceased, 20 living hostages, whom it is our moral and ethical duty to bring back to our border. I want to thank you all again, and to tell you that you are part of history, an unforgettable and inseparable part of what the Mossad has done and continues to do. Continue working shoulder to shoulder with our partners in the IDF and the Shin Bet, and in this way, we will keep bringing great achievements to the people of Israel. So thank you all very much. Well done, truly well done.
What do you make of that?
First of all, 25 hostages, and they're killing 50 to 100 innocent Palestinians every day. They're killing 50 to 100 innocent Palestinians every day by luring them to food sites and then shooting them deliberately. And we know this from testimony of IDF soldiers in recent days, carried in stories in Israeli media. They're mass murdering the Palestinians before our eyes. And this man talks about the moral and ethical responsibility. This man is a mass murderer. That's Mossad's job. Now, Mossad and the CIA have a very strong relationship. They are closely allied in many operations around the world, especially in the Middle East, but in other regions as well. And that is a very key part of American foreign policy and a very key part of the U.S.-Israel relationship. The Mossad-CIA connection goes back at least more than 60 years, we know. It's very strong, and I always emphasize it is the CIA where you find our foreign policy, not the White House especially. The CIA is the deep state. It keeps the long-term strategy, whether it's to try to weaken or overthrow governments in Russia or Iran or other places. It was the lead agency in a long war against the Syrian government that took hundreds of thousands of lives and culminated in a jihadist regime coming to power, which suddenly we declared to be our wonderful friend and ally, because in fact we run jihadists, the CIA does, and so does Mossad, contrary to what casual thought would suggest. So I'm not surprised by it, other than how clearly stated all of this is. That is just a long, professional, deadly, horrible relationship. Horrible because it has made a 4,000-kilometer swath of violence across North Africa, the Horn of Africa, the Eastern Mediterranean, and West Asia, running from Libya to Iran. This is murder incorporated, and murder, whether it's of the leaders for overthrows of government or mass murders of Palestinians, does not solve anything other than making mayhem and murder.
Is it realistic to fear that Trump will use nuclear weapons next time around?
I don't think so. I really doubt that. I think that, as I say, the United States has no security risk in the world other than a nuclear war. And I think that this is really understood by a lot of people who still make wars, who still say, oh, we're threatened by this, we're threatened by that, we're threatened by global terrorism. Remember the war on global terror and how Americans were terrorized by all of this, which was never a threat in the way that it was described. I don't believe that we're anywhere close to having a nuclear war over this. But if you push other nuclear powers like Russia or North Korea or Pakistan, you could certainly provoke a nuclear war. That is absolutely, or China, obviously, I should mention, over Taiwan, another phony issue. that would never be the issue it is were it not for the provocative American positions on this, because if it weren't for America arming Taiwan, Taiwanese politicians would never do the provocative things that they are actually doing, many of them, which bring us closer to a direct confrontation between the U.S. and China. In other words, I don't believe that this is leading to America's first use of a nuclear weapon, but I do believe it is leading us to the real possibility of a nuclear war that completely becomes a global annihilation. That, I think, is the real point I'm trying to make, which is that our foreign policy is so erratic, so irresponsible, so devoid of true international principles, so filled with a lot of BS, that that's what makes it very dangerous for us.
Would Netanyahu, is he crazy enough to use nuclear weapons against Iran?
Under certain circumstances, yes. If that Israel was threatened by a massive attack by Iran that followed an attack by Israel, then yes, that's absolutely possible, and that's one of the things that could trigger a global nuclear war. And Netanyahu absolutely would. That's why Israel has them. And Israel thinks it can provoke any side. It has pretended that its Iron Dome and other air defense systems give an absolute protection to Israel. Now we see that this is completely false. And so if Israel provokes another attack, and there's a massive attack from Iran that is threatening the heart of Israel, and one can imagine many ways that that could happen, then I have no doubt that Israel would contemplate the use of one or more of its nuclear weapons. So any state threatened with survival that has nuclear weapons would do so. This is definitely true of Israel, given this mentality that is there, which is stoking up dangers because it refuses to have any kind of real diplomacy with the Arab world over the core issue that has been the core issue for 100 years, and that is the right of Palestinians that also live in the same area as Israel and that Israel is occupying. And because of that, the violence continues to soar. Israel provokes. It is not in a strong position the way that it thinks it is, and last week exposed its vulnerabilities. It counts on the United States to rescue it, but we can see that the United States may say, no, don't do that. The Israel provokes, believing that the U.S. will follow. The U.S. doesn't follow. Mass response from Iranian side, and then Israel feels that its survival is a threat, and it uses a nuclear weapon, after which there could be many scenarios of Pakistan defending Iran or North Korea or many other things that one could imagine that could then lead on to a nuclear war that would rapidly get out of hand and destroy the world. That's why every single thing that we're doing in all of this is so unbelievably dangerous and reckless. It's hard to put into words without profanity, sorry to say. And while the president uses profanity, we're not going to use profanity the same way. And the fact of the matter is we need diplomacy. We need diplomacy to end the war in Ukraine. We need diplomacy to end a potential conflict over Taiwan. And we need diplomacy to create a state of Palestine alongside a state of Israel and to end Israel's wars of regime change, because these are the conflicts that could destroy the world, not in one step, but in one step with escalation, with retaliation, with the pressing one side to use a nuclear weapon, leading to a nuclear exchange, leading to a rapid escalation that ends the world. And there is a book that I may have mentioned in our past discussions, but I recommend it to anybody that wants a chilling and accurate account of how the world could come to an end in 2 hours and 10 minutes. It's called The Nuclear War, A Scenario, by the investigative journalist Annie Jacobson. It's a superb, accurate, technical, chilling account of what I'm describing, which could happen in any of these war zones, which is why we need diplomacy, not games, not regime change operations, not Lindsey Graham, our most dangerous and reckless senator, who posts game on as Israel strikes and the United States strikes Iran. Game on. This is not a game.
Professor Sachs, thank you very much. Thank you for your analysis, as painful as a lot of this is. Truly, truly and profoundly appreciated. Thank you for staying up for us. All the best,
of course,
friend. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى و دین.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough. Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
Bismillahi r-Rahman r-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
This is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a commemoration ceremony marking the 36th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's demise. The ceremony was held in Imam Khomeini's mausoleum on June 4th, 2025.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Based on a definite divine decree, the Zionist regime is collapsing. June 4th, 2025. Now, in the nuclear industry, there is one point that is a key element, and that is uranium enrichment. Our enemies have focused all their attention on this very process of uranium enrichment. They have concentrated their efforts on this. The nuclear industry of such immensity is useless without having the capability for enrichment, because we would then be dependent on others in order to obtain fuel for our power plants. It's like having crude oil in your country but not having the right to build a refinery or produce gasoline. You have crude oil, but you must buy a gasoline from someone else. And that country will sell it to you if it wants to at any price it chooses. And if it doesn't want to sell it to you, it won't. It will come up with an excuse and refuse to sell it. It will say, do this or that, otherwise I won't give you any gasoline. This is their goal. If we have 100 nuclear power plants but no uranium enrichment capability, it will be of no use to us, because a nuclear power plant needs fuel. If we can't produce that fuel domestically, we will be dependent on the US, and they may impose tens of conditions for giving us nuclear fuel. We have already tried this. Regarding 20% enriched fuel in the 2000s, the US president personally asked two presidents of countries who are friends with us to act as intermediaries. He told them to ask Iran to give a portion of its 3.5 enriched uranium, and the US would then provide the 20% enriched uranium that Iran needed. We needed 20% enriched uranium. Our officials accepted their proposal, and it was agreed that the exchange would take place. I said the deal must proceed in this way, that they bring the 20% enriched uranium to Bandar Abbas, and we would then test it to ensure its authenticity. Only then we would give the 3.5 enriched uranium to them. When they saw we were careful and insistent about receiving 20% enriched uranium, they broke their promise and didn't deliver it. Of course, during that time, when our officials were engaged in those political talks, our own scientists inside the country were able to produce the 20% enriched uranium themselves.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want
joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now, the Israeli occupation entity had enjoyed the impunity and political cover of the U.S. for over the years. It would either no longer exist, be a fraction of what it is, and generations of its leadership would have been targeted and incarcerated for egregious violations of international law, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. But what we see today is a red carpet treatment of a wanted war criminal in Benjamin Netanyahu as he visits the White House. Not only is his arrest warrant ignored, but the four judges who issued it at the International Criminal Court, they get sanctioned. And the UN rapporteur on Occupy Palestine, who's documented all the war crimes in Gaza for over 22 months, she gets sanctioned. And ICC Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan also faced sanctions back in February. And this is the focus of our Spotlight program. But first, let's begin with this report.
As global institutions pursue accountability for Israeli war crimes in Gaza, the United States responds not with support for justice, but with imposing sanctions and punitive measures. Washington is shielding its ally, the Israeli regime, from scrutiny and clearly emphasizes its unwavering support in the face of international law.
As President Trump and members of Congress roll out the red carpet for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a war criminal who will be remembered as one of the monsters of modern history.
So, is justice being served or silenced? In February, the U.S. sanctioned ICC Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan after he issued arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and former War Minister Yoav Gallant. Their charges were war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. Later on, Khan was banned from entering the U.S. and his assets were frozen. Then in June, four ICC judges were sanctioned for authorizing investigations into Israeli actions. The judges were accused of abusing power. Then the UN and ICC condemned the move as a threat to judicial independence. The latest target, Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine. Her July 2025 report accused Israel of committing genocide.
Following nearly 6 months of unrelenting Israeli assault on occupied Gaza, it is my solemn duty to report on the worst of what humanity is capable of and to present my finding, the anatomy of a genocide.
The U.S. imposed sanctions on her, froze her assets, and established travel ban after she criticized European nations for granting airspace to Benjamin Netanyahu for his trip to Washington, despite his ICC active arrest warrant. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has described Albanese's efforts as illegitimate and shameful.
I've been smeared, attacked, I've received threats. And this has been relentless for the past 16 months. Me and my family, we have been all defamed and threatened, including my children.
International institutions are facing mounting challenges in their efforts and at serving justice and accountability. The tension between sovereign interests and established global norms prompts critical evaluation. Washington's blind support for Israel and shielding the child killer regime constitutes a blatant deviation from long-standing principles of international law.
And now for your guests. Mr. Yves Engler, author and political activist, joining us from Montreal, Canada. And Daniel Tovalich, human rights lawyer, joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, out of the U.S. Hello, gentlemen. Pleasure to have you both join us on the program. I guess, Yves, we'll start with you out there in Montreal. Yves, giving the Israeli entity political cover, it's one thing, Yves, but this outright demonizing, targeting, and sanctioning people with a mandate to adjudicate or document crimes, you're taking on a whole different task here. Help us make a sense of what the U.S. is doing by targeting these people, including U.N. employees here.
Yeah, the scope Washington's willing to go in terms of enabling the Holocaust in Gaza is absolutely remarkable. This latest move is obviously an indication of that. And the UN should be moved out of New York. I mean, this is just another step down this pathway of targeting anyone, even if they are representing the whole international community, to help Israel commit more and more war crimes and slaughter against Palestinians. It's remarkable, but at this point, we have just seen one after another, after another, after another step down this path that Washington and its major allies have pursued in enabling Israel's crimes.
Right, and Daniel, welcome to the conversation here, and thank you for your patience, and also your initial thoughts as well, please, Daniel, on how the U.S. continues to kill the messenger here when the message and those involved in it. They encompass the most despicable crimes crimes against the humanity that this generation has witnessed.
Yeah, well, you know, a number of people pointed out the incredible irony that in the same week that the U.S. has now recognized and lifted all sanctions on the al-Qaeda leader of Syria, al-Jalani, and removed his group from the list of terrorists, has decided instead to sanction human rights activists and leaders. It really says everything about where the U.S. is today. They are the enemy of international law, the enemy of human rights. And as an American, I couldn't be more disappointed.
Thank you, Daniel. And now, Yves, this week, Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on Occupied Palestine, she named 48 companies that are using the Gaza genocide to fine-tune their products and make billions from the onslaught. Tech giants, weapons manufacturers, heavy equipment manufacturers, banks, even charities there, Yves, imploring them to boycott working with Tel Aviv. She also asked European countries just the other day to not allow their airspace to be used by Benjamin Netanyahu, a wanted war criminal, to get to the States. And he gets there, ultimately, and then Donald Trump sanctions her, right, for this week's and other work that she's done in the past. I mean, in a just world, Eve, she deserves an award on her work for the Palestinian people, not the kind of scrutiny she's getting.
Yeah, well, Netanyahu suggesting Trump should get the Peace Prize for bombing Iran. Obviously, Albanese should be in any sane world would be a thousand times more proper candidate for that. I think that that contrast is just is remarkable that they she's demonized even though she's the one combating genocide. I think that the probably part of this timing is that was the report was quite impactful. I know here in Quebec, it got a lot of attention, the fact that the major pension fund in Quebec is invested in genocide. And he cited that in her report, some of the stuff on the Caisse de dépôt here in Quebec. And that got a lot of attention. And I think that was probably quite frustrating from Israel's perspective, and from Washington's perspective. So that's maybe one of the explanations for this timing of these sanctions. But yeah, in a big picture, I mean, it's the idea that the person who is putting everything on the line, in a sense, at least in the mental health or career on the line, not like Palestinians in Gaza are putting everything on the line, but that they're targeted for doing everything they can to expose and to oppose these crimes, and then the criminal is celebrated in Washington for multiple days is quite a contrast.
And Daniel, your thoughts on the Trump administration sanctioning someone who has, to Eve's point, almost put practically everything on the line to carry out such a tedious task, Daniel, of documenting all of and opening the world's eyes to Israel's war crimes in Gaza and occupied West Bank. Now, this report we just mentioned with the 48 companies she mentioned the other week, that report was called From Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide. And that comes on the heels of another lengthy report. I'm just trying to outline how much time and energy she has exhausted on the Palestinian, especially this 22 months of Gaza genocide. That comes on the heels of another report called Anatomy of a Genocide, Daniel. That was from March of 2024. And another report in October of 2024 called Genocide as Colonial Erasure. Now, in the latter, Albanese identifies how Israel is expanding its genocide from Gaza to the occupied West Bank. Israel is the outlaw in this Wild West gunfight. And Albanese, she's the sheriff. What does that make, Daniel, the U.S. here?
Yeah, well, the U.S. is the enabler of this genocide. And Francesca Albanese is playing, if I may use a biblical term, really a prophetic role by calling that out. And as you say, giving everything, her sacrificing herself. By the way, I think as special rapporteur, I don't think she even gets paid. Maybe gets like a dollar or something for her work. I mean, this is basically volunteer work she's doing to advocate for the Palestinian people, to condemn a genocide, which everyone should be condemning, and then to be punished for doing that with these sanctions is outrageous. Again, it says everything about the people punishing her, right? She is the one who should get a Nobel Peace Prize. That is a no-brainer, right? And if she doesn't, it will be just an outrage, right? But we live in a time that, frankly, someone like George Orwell couldn't even satirize, right? It satirizes itself. War is peace. Again, as my colleague Eves pointed out, that you have this ridiculous show at the White House where Netanyahu shows him a letter where he's been nominated for the Peace Prize. It reminds me of when Hitler was nominated for the Peace Prize. I mean, it's that crazy. But we live in an upside-down world in which, you know, a lot of people's moral compass does not point to due north anymore.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
World Eve, the targeting of Karim Khan, also ICC chief prosecutor, and his team for issuing these arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu, his ex-war minister Yoav Gallant, for crimes against humanity, including using food and starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza. Eve, the U.S. Treasury sanctioned the ICC team. Please tell me what their crime exactly is here. Well, how do they deserve to get sanctioned? How is their issuance of these arrest warrants not praised and applauded instead.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, the criticism is that they've been way too slow and they haven't moved forward on this, of course. The Karim Khan should be criticized for being way too passive in the face of Israel's violations of international law. But the Trump administration, goes after them like that. And I should say here, my there's been two recent votes at the Human Rights Council, UN Human Rights Council, and the Canadian government, which claims to have been a big player in establishing the ICC and supports it, it has refused to endorse these two resolutions condemning these attacks against ICC officials. And in fact, previously, 5 years ago, I think it was in 2020, the Canadian government even sent a letter to the ICC, basically pressuring them, threatening the funding, Canada's funding to the ICC, if they investigated Israel's war crimes. So this is the Trump administration has taken things to a whole new level, but this is kind of part of a broader pattern where any effort to uphold international law when it comes to Israel, that Washington specifically, but also Canada and some other NATO countries, that they target those who are slowly trying to hold Israeli officials accountable for what are, of course, vast crimes.
And Daniel, this is obviously nothing new. This is not something that's just restricted to this term. Donald Trump, we know back in his first term, he also went after another IEC team, canceling their visas. If you remember the time, that was, I believe, Fatou Ben Souda's team. He canceled their visas. He told her he's going to sanction her and target her personally for going after U.S. war crimes and probing them in Afghanistan and in Iraq in his first term. Now, her name was Fatou Ben Souda. And the funny thing is that at the time, Mossad director Yossi Cohen also was personally involved in a plot to threaten and pressure Fatou Ben Souda to drop a Palestine investigation of war crimes back in Trump's first term, obviously committed by the Israeli regime against the people of Palestine. This is a systemic. This is basically the, what do you guys call it, the modus operandi for these two entities here.
Yeah, and again, I mean, it's just outrageous because when the West wants to wage war, they like to weaponize human rights to do that, right? And weaponize the ICC to do that. They like to use the International Criminal Court against other countries, right? Other world leaders like Vladimir Putin, for example, mostly against African leaders, right? It used to, in fact, some people joked it was the African Criminal Court. But they don't want it applied. They don't want the ICC's rules or its gaze to be applied to Western leaders, right? It's good enough for others, but not for the West. Even though, of course, Bill Clinton's administration played a key role in helping draft the Rome Statute of the ICC, and then, of course, refused to have it ratified. All these things just show the pretextual nature of human rights when it comes to the West. Right. They use it totally opportunistically.
And that abuse as using it totally opportunistically, Eves, I want to put that to you. What does this do? The selective adjudication of international law and its application, who has to answer for war crimes and who doesn't? What does this do for the rule of law?
Well, there is no rule of law in international affairs, unfortunately, and the basics of international law are just violated. This isn't new. Of course, the U.S. has done this all the time, and its allies. Look at the bombing of Yugoslavia in 1999, obviously the invasion of Iraq in 2003, crass violations of international law. So this isn't new, but what we've seen in the past 21 months is a rapid escalation on that front. And I think to the point that Dan's making about human rights just being completely politicized. I mean, it's just totally it's so crass how Canada's parliament will pass a unanimous resolution about